This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
What I'd like to do now is to I had a little section here called New Directions, which was really just to look at what perhaps some students might be doing in this area at the moment, related to directly or indirectly to Emily or Utopia or Indigenous art in the centre. And there are two young PhD students who are probably feeling dreadfully nervous who would just give us... I've just asked if they'd just like to give us 10 minutes at least of what they're doing and the direction they're taking. And I think it'll be helpful not only for us to sort of perhaps hear that, but also helpful for them if we can direct them, assist them, if not in here, but just out there later if they need to talk to some people. So, and the first one is Krishona Schmidt, and Krishona is a PhD student at the Cross Cultural Research Centre at the Australian National University, and her research examines Emily's role as a painter within the community of Utopia. But I also have to add, this girl has done all the voluntary work to do the forum, because I was a little busy with a few other things, and you know, there's lots of nuts and bolts with this kind of thing, especially as I decided I may be able to squeeze in one more thing. And it's only like 2 weeks ago I thought I just can't not, you know, provide this opportunity. So Krishona, fortunately, was drifting by at the time, like some others were, grabbed her, and she was very happy to volunteer. So she's a person you've been talking to, and I hope it's... And I'm hoping for Krishona that she makes contact with the people that around here who will be able to assist her with her research as well. So a welcome to Krishona.
Thank you, Margot. Thank you very much. We heard yesterday throughout the day some new insights and approaches to Emily's work. They were taking up new perspectives, to understand her work in a different way. We heard also today contemporary issues, modernity issues. Then we heard yesterday also retelling the history of Emily's work. What is a ritual in relation to her work? Well, my approach and my research includes a lot of these aspects that we've touched on. So one of them is the development of her art throughout the 30 or the 8 years she painted, but she did batiks before, so that's included in it. So that, with that I mean stylistic periods and also new themes about which Christopher Hodges spoke. Then the next topic I'm interested in is the different people who have been involved in marketing, selling and exhibiting her work. So how has it been exposed to the world, how what this session before was just on about. And next point we touched on was, through Sally's talk mainly, how does she fit in with these people she lived with Gloria who was here, with Barbara, with her whole family, with the community. How did she share her dreamings with them and also country? How is this group made up? So, but I don't just want to look at Emily. Emily is a big part of it. But I'm interested in how over the 30 or so years now, the development of Utopia art has come about. How can we look at it from a general perspective, maybe not seeing it as an Aboriginal art movement in general, but as a Utopia art movement? So having a local art history. And what are the influences that Emily has experienced and also other Aboriginal artists have experienced, such as the physical influences through her country, the environment, the seasons she experienced, but also the spiritual ones of which we heard before, dreaming, ritual, and then, as I said, kin, the sharing and teaching of knowledge, the daily negotiation of relationships, and finally, the art market and its demands. So as we heard Christopher implying, also Susan McCullough, there are different art markets, and how did she react to these different art markets? And did she change because Christopher implied she wasn't? So even that would be very interesting, that she said, oh, I'll do my own thing, even if it's commissioned. But that ties into another notion within art history. An artist has his or her own agency all the time. So as an individual, she has a choice to paint what she wants to paint and how to do it, and she has a choice to negotiate it, and so does every other artist in this community. So what is agency in relation to her style and to her work? And then another thing that was touched on yesterday just by a brief question that really interests me in the long run is, how has she had an influence, not just outside, but inside the community? How has her way of expressing her country, herself, really putting herself onto canvas, influenced other artists in the community? And how is that an ongoing process and not stopped when she passed away? But this is really what Margot outlined before. That would be her legacy, in a way, within the community. And I think that'd be very interesting to look at, even if people say, well, no, that's her thing. She's autonomous. I'm doing my thing. Well, that's a, again, coming back to individuality and agency of the artist. So as Susan pointed out yesterday, Utopia consists of 15 outstations, and there are about 200 to 300 artists there. And how does Emily's work fit into, or her whole oeuvre fit into this community? And can all of these 15 outstations, as we have done in this symposium so far, be grouped as one community and say, oh, this is one Utopia style? Or do we have to, in fact, think about it, rethink that category and say, no, there are 15 outstations and now 15 countries and now probably more than 15 different families living around. So that's one thing I would like to explore in the long run, if we can, in relation to what's been done in Europe for a very long time. We've grouped artists in all sorts of voluntary associations, like artists' groups, workshops, communities. Well, can we do that with Utopia? And in all these groups that we know from European art, there's often, not always, but often, a single leader. Well, can Emily be that? Or is that totally misconceived? So my research really focuses on tracing back all these different aspects that I've mentioned, going through time from the 1970s till now. And I'm trying to build up a local art history, and that's taking up part of what Terry said. Thank you.
PhD students, it's a big era. There'll be a lot of dropping back because it's great stuff. And some of that local on the ground stuff hasn't been done. We've all got carried away with the art and taken it off. So thank you. I wish you luck and be interested to help you and follow it. The next speaker is Gwen Horsfield. Hello. Gwen is also obviously a PhD candidate at the Art History Department at ANU, and her thesis actually is a bit broader. It examines Australia's participation at the Venice Biennale, of which, of course, Emily is one of the three artists. Oh, no, more than that, one of them. She's actually doing the participation from 1978 to 2007, of which Emily was one of the lucky pupils.
Okay, thanks very much, Margot. As Margot said, the period that my research considers is 1978 to 2007, which was a period of enormous social and political change within Australian society, and that also encompasses the the rise to prominence of Indigenous art. So I'm arguing for sort of the broader contextualisation of Emily's art within that. And my paper is titled Emily in Venice, Australian Art and Identity at the 1997 Venice Biennale. Venice is a city with a long history of cross-cultural encounters. The meeting of cultures that this paper will address took place in 1997 at the oldest and most prestigious of international art competitions, the Venice Biennale. It was here amidst the glamour and high finance of the global centre of capitalist art tourism that Australia showcased one of its most valuable and internationally recognised cultural exports, the art of Emily Carm Imwari. My doctoral research considers the history of Australia's participation in the Venice Biennale as a kind of microcosm of changes in the national field of cultural production. Over time, the roles played by commerce, the arts bureaucracy, and the global media have been shaped by a range of political and economic imperatives. However, my discussion today focuses on Emily's contribution and examines the 1997 joint exhibition Fluent within the context of the ideological project conducted by Australia at the Biennale. What the present Australian Commissioner Doug Hall calls the advocacy of Venice, making Australia look very, very good. Despite its status and influence, the Venice Biennale is regarded as something of an anachronism among contemporary art shows. Because the bulk of the exhibits are separated into the category of individual nation states and funded primarily by their respective governments, the event remains a unique vehicle for displays of nationalism within the global art scene. Australia quite openly utilises this diplomatic aspect of the Biennale, but unfortunately the selection process has a history of being dominated by political conservatism and artistic insularity. Throughout the 1950s, Prime Minister Robert Menzies closely controlled the selection of art for export, and this resulted in some very poorly received exhibitions in Venice. The 1958 show, consisting of landscape paintings by Arthur Streeton and Arthur Boyd, drew unfavourable comparisons with the lifeless scenery of geographic magazines and was even likened to the propagandising of the Soviet pavilion. Members of the contemporary art scene at home were appalled that they were being represented by Streeton, who by then had been dead for 15 years. On hearing of the lukewarm international reception to Australia's entry, Menzies declared that, I quote, the Biennale was run by crackpots, and withdrew federal government support altogether. Although Menzies and the modernists were on opposing sides of the artistic debate, both were equally conscious that what appears at Venice is seen by the world not to represent only the best, to represent not only the best of Australian art, but in many ways a broader vision of Australian culture and society. Australia was not to participate again until 1978, and since then, under the auspices of the Australia Council, has met with varying degrees of critical and commercial success. The process of fostering a national identity through the arts is no longer left to chance. It is now literally part of the Australian Council's mission statement, and you'll find it on their website. The possibility of sending Aboriginal art to Venice was raised in Australia as early as 1952. An Italian-Australian woman named Elizabeth Fagioli Griffiths petitioned public servants and arts bureaucrats with letters urging them to create a pavilion at Venice that included, I quote, both the Australian School of Art and the Aboriginal Art. In the era of the White Australia policy, her efforts went unrewarded. Aboriginal artists did not represent Australia for the first time until 1990, long after they had risen to prominence within Australian art history and the international art market. Trevor Nichols and Rover Thomas were selected for that landmark show. 7 years later, Fluent, managed by the Art Gallery of New South Wales, brought together exclusively female Indigenous artists and curators. The exhibition sought to convey, I quote, the ideals of excellence and contemporaneity, as well as a fluidity of expression and fluency of method. It featured Emily's work alongside that of the rural fibre craft practitioner Yvonne Coolmaitre, as well as urban artist Judy Watson, who filled the lower level of the Australian Pavilion with an installation of unstretched canvases, painted bronze stones, and periodic performances by Russell Page of the Bangarra Dance Company. 8 untitled paintings by Emily from 1994 to 5 were shown, all of them displaying the economy of brush strokes and reduction in form and colour that signalled yet another distinct stylistic shift in her oeuvre. Curator Hetty Perkins emphasised in her essay the rhythm and universality of Emily's motifs, saying that the stripe is a mark that is globally occurring, like a word in a language we can all understand. What appealed to curators and industry professionals, however, did not necessarily appeal to the art-buying public. Earlier in 1997, Sotheby's had informed a collector who submitted a work for sale, a work by Emily, that is, that the auction house was not interested in the lines period, nor in the slapdash works with muddy colours. They wanted works of high quality. The complexity, precision, and harmonious colours of the late 80s and early 90s were apparently more accessible to a market-oriented audience, while later minimalist and seemingly less considered paintings remained interesting to theorists and academics who sought to place the artist within a globalising concept of contemporary art. For some viewers, the later styles also signalled a deterioration in quality, as the pressure of the so-called Emily industry compelled the artist to be ever more prolific. It is perhaps inevitable that the richness of her work diminished. Although the curatorial rationale of Fluent was to demonstrate the endurance and continuity of Aboriginal culture, the irony of presenting this within an implicitly nationalist forum was not lost on international audiences. Critics were impressed by Emily's work, but described Australia's overall contribution as introspective, reformist, and uncourageous. One unsympathetic reviewer wrote that it was worth the trip to Venice just to see the sight of half the art world staggering under the weight of their history, while the other half looked on smugly. These problems cannot be solved merely by exporting them. At home, the critical response struck an uneasy balance between praise, citing the unfailing appeal of Indigenous art to international audiences, and censure for, I quote, projecting our political priorities into an uncaring international showcase. I think that one was John MacDonald. Ironically, the year that Fluent went to Venice was not an especially triumphant one for the Aboriginal arts industry. As preparations for the show were underway, budget cuts of $350 million in state funding to the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission were announced. The impact of these financial constraints was felt substantially by art centres established by Aboriginal women's councils throughout remote areas of Western Australia, South Australia, and the Northern Territory, in some cases resulting in a lack of electricity and running water. Charges of official tokenism abounded, for in the words of Joe Dyer, at the same time that the federal government is parading Indigenous people and cultures on the world stage, they are ripping our funding to bits. In Europe, controversy lingered over the second rejection of Aboriginal art by the German organisers of the Cologne Art Fair, who claimed that the art did not meet their contemporary exhibition standards. Meanwhile, at home, two incidents in particular brought the vexed question of authenticity to the fore in public debate. Firstly, allegations that Kathleen Pecciari's prize-winning Storm in Atnangir Country 2, apologies if that pronunciation's not right, had been painted primarily by her white husband, Jim Beamish. And secondly, the revelation that the moderately successful and ostensibly Aboriginal painter, Eddie Burrup, was in fact an elderly white woman from a family of wealthy pastoralists. So the year 1997's remarkable succession of events, each dramatised by journalists eager to assume the role of moral watchdogs, demonstrated that the criteria for determining the authenticity, contemporaneity, and aesthetic and economic value of Aboriginal art were as contentious as ever. What frustrated many Indigenous commentators was that simultaneously these debates played out in a public arena saturated with the corporate and government appropriation of Aboriginal imagery. Tribal iconography has been ubiquitous in Australian popular and consumer culture since the 80s, adorning everything from Qantas Boeing jets to Australia Post Office uniforms and Olympic Games spectacles. What occurs domestically is arguably magnified in Venice. A tension between the inherently regional qualities of Aboriginal art and the nationalist aspirations of state and big business. To say nothing of the sad irony of a regime that makes cultural ambassadors of its own repressed. International audiences, accustomed to the official use of Aboriginality as a form of nation branding, may not have been aware of the extent or divisiveness of these underlying issues back home. Emily Kam Emwara's work has been described in the past as being without obvious Aboriginality or political content. But when it is examined in the context of a nation-state ideology being presented on the world stage, against the backdrop of post-colonial anxieties and the goal of making Australia look very, very good, it takes on an almost subversive political significance and thus fulfils a most vital function of contemporary art, regardless of the intentions of its maker.
Thank you.
No, it's not there. You're right. thank you, Gwen, for that. There's a lot of meat in that. It's a nice broad perspective, and it's good to get some other international reactions through the reviews, which we often forget.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.